Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Bua Cordia. That's Irish for big welcome. How are you doing? Because this week, today actually, we've started a 6 week, is it 6 weeks?
I don't know, is it?
I think it is. Irish course online run through a Dublin university. It looks pretty sophisticated. And what is interesting is A, you, the Spanish person, highlighted it to me. But then again, maybe that makes more sense because why would an Irish person be learning Irish, you might ask. But then again, the plot thickens because people have presented themselves, sorry, it's a Spanglish word, have introduced themselves on the course. And, oh, by the way, Mary's with me. Say hello.
Hello.
Sorry, just got lost there. There's a mixture of like foreigners, few Hispanic looking people, not by profile, their names. That sounds like Trumpian almost.
I was going to say, like Hispanic looking people. No, there are people from all over the world.
Yeah. And Irish people, like trying to relearn their language, for example. Yeah. So it is pretty amazing. It's a sophisticated platform. They have videos, they have software where you can record your voice and play it back, and you can like share, I think, that with other people so they can check your pronunciation. They have two AI robots, one called Niamh, not Nympho, and Oisin, not Oscar.
It's Oscar.
But they tell you where the names come from. Oisin was one of the warriors of the Tutankhamun. And Oscar, I don't know who he is, but he makes an appearance at some point. So
we're going to take after we finish.
Yeah. Well, the first lesson for us today is the OM writing, which I'm actually very interested to learn about, because that is a very old style of writing and it predates Harry Potter, substantially.
Well, okay then.
But like, I actually skipped some of the courses because I am Irish, so I just, not some of the courses, but some of the first parts. But you actually watched the video to really describe where the different regions of the world. You have Gaelic. No, you didn't see that? Okay, well, you skipped that
no,
as well.
No, but because I knew that already.
But of course you did. You know, yes. Me, so.
Exactly. Munster is the best.
It is. Yeah, Ulster is more difficult to understand. Of course, you have Gaelic in Scotland as well, and it's related to the Breton languages, which you can find, of course, in France. And I think there's other ones as well, like the Celtic language. I think Manx or Manx as well is related to Irish. But it's quite interesting the kind of similarities it has to other languages in the surrounding geography. And then they talk about, tips to learn Irish. Well, this course that we're doing would be is a big step forward as well. So what are your hopes, dreams, your aspirations? What are the outcomes you're hoping for with this course?
Well, I'm hoping I'll kind of like reinforce what I've already learned in the past.
Yeah.
But also specifically like pronunciation. Try to get the hang of the pronunciation because I think that's the most difficult thing.
I can't wait for that because really my pronunciation of all languages is terrible, bar English and bar Irish because of Irish.
But it's not though.
My Spanish accent can be dodgy.
No, it's not dodgy at all.
Sí.
No.
Gracias. even though my students in one particular class keep making fun of me for how I say words.
Yeah, our students always make fun of us.
Yeah, I think it's like a psychological trick where they want to restore the balance. It's psychological like that. Sick puppies. We'll be talking about more psychology, maybe at the tail. That got bitter very quickly. At the tail end of part one, or we'll be bumping that into part two. We'll see how this goes. So the Irish course, I guess, is there anything else that we can say about it? We'll be learning blessings, curses, place names, how to read, witchcraft. Witchcraft. No, well, maybe actually.
Where you like blazing gifts?
Yeah, I mean, learning how to count. Well, spells. The good thing is, like, it is a really introductory course. Like, you will be able to learn after doing it how to count, how to present yourself, how to introduce yourself, I should say, once you have that kind of base, as basic as that is, I think you do feel good, because you can say, my name is this, and I like this, and these are my hobbies. And I think once you have that established, you have something that you can say. And once you have that, then I think that is motivation to continue and to learn more of the language. Because, you know, if you can just construct a few sentences, that's your way in, that's your key. Mm. And then you can do other courses, I guess. Yes. So it's quite interesting, I think. So anything else you want to say about the course before we kind of move on to item B?
No, by the time we're finished, we'll be reviewing it as we go along, but then we'll just be giving our opinion.
Yeah. It looks professional. The people behind it seem good crack. Sound bunch of lads.
The lecturers,
yeah. Oisin and Niamh haven't caused any problems yet. And there's an international group of people learning Irish. What's not to like?
Maybe.
Yeah, got stuck in my words there. But yeah, well, it's kind of interesting as well how... I was also talking about, like, Native Americans before the podcast, no? And their culture, because there's an interesting feature about them. And it just kind of, like, grabbed my attention, because their status in American society isn't very good. They're kind of on the margins of society. We'll be talking about that, actually, in part two as well, because Mr. Goebbels, no, not Goebbels, Himmler, had a fascination with Native Americans and wanted to convert them or bring him over to Germany, and also he hoped that they would fight against the Americans. So that kind of crazy situation we'll kind of elaborate more on in the second part. But yeah, so like the life expectancy of men, according to this, was 48. For women, it was 52. For this, there's different tribes, and they were forcibly removed from the Black Hills during the conquest of the West, how the West was won. And in the 80s, they were offered a cash settlement, which was in the millions, hundreds of millions, and now it's grown to like something in the billions. But the point is that, you know, even though they are kind of impoverished, maybe not fully in society, once a year they have a traditional festival where they kind of meet up and sing the old songs and dance those dances and still speaking their language as well. And I was thinking, as I said to you as well, like that, it kind of like struck me that in Ireland we don't speak our language, but these people who are kind of on the margin still have that. But I was thinking that, well, I guess they're like Gaeltacht speakers, where there's like this English language culture around them, but there are these pockets that keep on the old ways, for example. And so it kind of made me feel a little bit less bad about the status of Irish in Ireland, but very, very impressed about how these proud people still maintain their traditions and how it's still very important for them, and they can still connect to those songs and connect to those dances and speak in that language. And the reason, by the way, as well, I didn't explain why they didn't accept that cash settlement is because they argue that they didn't sell the Black Hills, so why would they accept money for it? They were forcibly removed off it. But in another podcast way back when we were talking about this big project to poetry in different languages, there's also a great BBC podcast connected to that as well. You know, Native Americans who had lost their language came back to it, and they saw the world in a completely different way as well. So I think it's language obviously is a great indicator of identity. If you don't speak your native language, it doesn't mean you don't have a right to feel, you know, 100% this or that. But I think once you do acquire that language, it does allow you to connect in a deeper way to that identity. And I'm really looking forward and relishing the chance of jumping into it and learning more about Irish, Ireland, and myself. So, Begara. Anyway, so, yeah, I guess I dominated that a little bit. So, you say something before we go to part
just
two.
Just any random thing.
Any random thing. How's the car?
No, I think I haven't fixed it yet. No, I think we can go move on to part two.
No, I feel more confident if we stretch this out for another minute.
All right, then. What do you want to talk about?
No, don't look at that. That's all part two stuff now. And part three.
What about Italian philosophy?
That's part two stuff. We're going to kick off part two with that. Actually, one thing I've been doing with students is, like, 70-year-olds are cool, and, like, when they're rocking out when they're 70, you know, they won't be listening to Paso Doble. They'll be listening to Queen or whatever. Because apparently, according to two studies in the UK and one in Sweden, people who are 70 are having a lot of fun now and you know, enjoying life, which is nice for people of a certain vintage. So my question is, Mary, when you are 70, what are you going to be listening to in the old residencia, old folks home?
Bollywood?
Bollywood?
Maybe. I mean, we have some groups of elderly people that dance Bollywood too.
Wait, there's 3 seconds left until it's 10 minutes.
Oh, okay.
But since you started, I'll let you finish. Okay, continue.
No, just, you know, it's something that even elderly people do, and we have some colleagues that one of them is 92.
She dances Bollywood.
He
dances Bollywood.
Yes.
What a legend. Okay, on that note, we'll strike off for part one. And after this musical interlude, we'll be coming, approaching fast, to part two of the, you say that part.
Podcast.
Yeah, I was going to say show, but okay.
Oh.
So, welcome to part two of the show. We have a busy, busy roster. Talking about Oscar movies, even though, well, I mean, it's not in season anymore. Of course, we've missed the Oscar ceremonies. You already know who's won. But it doesn't matter, because we're talking about these movies because they're genuinely interesting. And obviously, that was reflected in their Oscar nominations, but not dependent on that fact, so we can feel free to talk about them. Now. Okay, so, where do we even start? I guess, what we can do is we'll talk a little bit maybe about the short documentaries.
Okay.
Because that's like a little, something small as a taster appetizer for part two. Then we'll jump into Capernaum. Was that what it's called?
Capernaum.
Whatever. Yeah, that one. which we saw last Thursday as well. And a few other bits and pieces of interest. So I know you haven't seen some of the short documentaries. You've seen other ones. I've seen a few as well. And they're quite interesting. One was about, well, the three I saw, one was about refugees coming from Africa and how they're picked up by kind of European vessels and the kind of trials and tribulations they go through there. We also saw a documentary about Madison Square Garden, where in 1933, I believe, there was a huge Nazi rally, and that was so interesting as well, because there's a lot of mostly German Americans, so they were of German extraction originally, but some Americans there as well. And then the third one was about an African American, but a black guy in England whose family moved to an estate run by kind of Nazis, not Nazis I guess, but racists, kind of thugs. And because he was black, they did like Hitler salutes and things like that. I'm not sure if they actually were far right extremists, but maybe that's just how they chose to represent that, you know, which is also interesting because you also saw the movie Green Book, which you'll also mention, and Viggo Mortensen got in trouble for using the N-word, and we'll kind of go into that a little bit as well, because that links in a way to the documentary, but it's kind of interesting, I think, to examine all of that. But we'll start with the Nazi one, because we've been watching historical movies, and this is obviously very historical. What I think is amazing is that it's 20 minutes long documentary. This guy found this footage he went for dinner with a screenwriter, and a screenwriter friend of his, and he said, he's writing a movie or a book about New York, and he said, you'll never guess that in Madison Square Garden there's this huge Nazi rally. And he didn't believe him. And then he kind of found it online, just like little excerpts in documentary. So it was never really the main focus of the documentary, but it was always just there in the background. And he's like, well, where is the rest of this footage? And he found it, and he put it together, just to put it together, kind of like a rough edit. And he was going to put a narration over it, but he didn't, because he felt like this, the footage itself was very compelling. And it is, because it has all the pageantry. I mean, but the Nazis obviously were terrible, but they were very sophisticated with propaganda. Again, that's not like obviously an endorsement. They were, you know, very evil, but they had their political machine very sophisticated in terms of propaganda. And what struck me was like that watching this documentary, this is also very, what's the word I can use, very well orchestrated. It looked amazing as a spectacle, which is what Nazi spectacles were supposed to be. And again, I say amazing in terms of scale and size, not in any positive connotation, because obviously what they represent is truly awful. There's an amazing incident where this Italian Jew kind of runs on stage. He said like he wasn't going to do anything, but he just went to see what was happening, because he knew, of course, these guys were anti-Semitic. But because what they were saying was so awful, he just felt he had to do something. And he got like taken off stage, beaten up by what looked like brown shirts. It's black and white, so it's hard to tell. But again, the kind of architecture or the artifices of what we think of Nazis and, you know, thugs in Berlin beating up political opponents, this is like what was being represented in New York. It's incredible. Anyway, he was fined for a breach of the peace by a court. He was arrested, of course. And he was told, like, you know, you were breaking the peace. And he was like, but you don't understand what these guys represent. Anyway, he went to fight in Second World War, survived. And that was always, like, a story he told that was, like, a pride of place. Of course, because he stood up to a great evil, you know. So, yeah, very compelling documentary. Also in the context of current times, because some reports this week show how UKIP, who are never the most centre party anyway, have gone further down the road of being right wing. They've gotten into bed with Tommy Robinson of the formerly of the EDL as well. Very interesting article as well in some of the papers about. Well, I mean, I guess you saw the story about the right wing extremist in America who wanted to take down Jews and a few other people. No,
I'm not sure.
Okay, well, I don't remember his name, but he was. He was caught like the last couple of weeks. He was arrested on drug and gun offences, and then they discovered that actually he was a Nazi and he was planning to kill people on a massive scale. And the scary thing is there's a lot of people like him in America, apparently, who operate in these like small cells of like 10 or 12 people. You know, and even the ones that aren't connected with other people, they can kind of like act alone as well. And what the problem is, they live in this fantasy world where they think Donald Trump is fighting some kind of deep state, and they think that he is being persecuted. I mean, for example, Donald Trump went to Vietnam recently to talk to the leader of North Korea. Because of his lack of preparedness and his incompetence, it descended into farce and was over very quickly. But then yesterday, he was blaming Michael Cohen's testimony for the failure of the talks. And there's nothing to see. That's a Spanish expression. There's nothing to do between those two situations, you know. But there's going to be people who are going to interpret it as such because they live in this La La Land. Not the Oscar-winning movie, or the almost Oscar-winning movie from last year. And what's also interesting is because, like... You know, because Russell Brand had a great podcast as well on Saturday where he's talking to these two lefties about how the left can kind of make these emotional arguments that the far right can make that reaches people. Because what's happening to the left now is that they're not reaching anybody, really. And I think there's some factors for that because, like, the left, when they make emotional arguments, have to be in favor of something progressive. And that's harder to mobilize people around, I think. But if you're far right, it's much easier to mobilize people against something. So that's an ace up their sleeve. But also they were saying, like, you know, I mean, but they don't address this in the podcast, actually, but I was thinking, like, while listening to it, while they're saying a lot of interesting things, one thing that is very difficult to understand is how the left, even if they have great politics, are very passionate. They're really big, passionate politicians on like charismatic platforms and all that, how they can still penetrate people who have these fixed views, and we've seen it with Brexit and everything as well, where the facts, when they don't correspond with their narrative, are just discarded and people kind of just perpetuate their own kind of story, you know. So I know we're going off in a bit of a tangent perhaps, but it's all connected to this idea of Nazism and far-right extremism, because that's what we saw in New York City, how incredible that was. It's New York City, it's America fighting the Nazis, you know, in the Second World War, and here in the second city, the great American city of New York, this demonstration of an ugly dogma. And even the mayor of New York at the time was against it, but he felt it was, by exposing this idea to the air, people would ultimately reject it. But it's also interesting as well, because like there are a lot of parallels in a way between America and Nazism, because Hitler loved how slavery was enshrined in the American Constitution in the past. He was also very impressed by how they slaughtered millions of Native Americans, and then because it was never really codified in law, like there was never a written instruction to do that, it just happened and it was encouraged. And that's a tactic he employed as well when he was, you know, involved with the Holocaust. There's very few examples actually of it written down, of a communique, you know, kill the Jews, but it was inferred. And what happened was, like, he thrived in this chaos of people interpreting his orders and going very far in trying to impress him, for example. But so he was, like, very impressed by how, you know, they also stopped immigration to America, how they, you know, the Jim Crow laws, for example, which were based on Nuremberg laws, for example. And the idea is, you know, even though it seems, you know, that's why, you know, in a way there's like a current parallel there, even though we think like, well, the Americans fought against the Nazis. But also as well, you know, in New York, a lot of people thought the Nazis were a fringe group. In Germany, they were seen as a fringe group as well, until the economy collapsed as well. And even going on a further tangent, there's a documentary about people who believe in a flat earth, and it's easy to laugh at these people. But a lot of scientists were saying, yeah, but within a generation, these people could be a political force, they could be in the government, they could be in their schools, for example. And it is true. So, you know, it just is a reminder that like people like this walk among us, and sometimes they have a great show of force, and even when it's subtle, it's just a danger there in society that we have to be very careful about. And it's good that it's shocking for a lot of people that there was this kind of show of Nazi solidarity in Madison Square Gardens. But fascism today and right wing ideology, and they mentioned this in the Russell Brand podcast as well, is different today, but it's no less dangerous and toxic and even subtle as it erodes things in society. So it's interesting as a curiosity, but also it has its parallels with modern life as well. So I don't know. I think it's an amazing documentary. So I don't know what you think about that.
No, it sounds really fascinating. It really makes me want to watch it. It's a lot to pack in 20 minutes. So
yeah, it's on YouTube as well. So the great thing is, like, because the Oscar-winning documentary about the period, that's on Netflix, and the other documentaries I saw were all on YouTube. So it's very easy to find them. Now, there's the one as well I think you'd find very interesting, which is about the refugees as well. We did one before about Salvados, no? You remember the one about...
Yes, of course, yeah.
So, what do you remember from the Salvados episode we watched?
No, that was a special episode they did on... Well, they were just following the open arms... boat that basically is mainly a Spanish team.
Yeah.
That just helps refugees when they find them in the sea, and they just rescue them because no country wants to take responsibility for it, and they've got into a lot of legal troubles because of that, because of like helping people that just were at sea. So,
well, it's interesting you say that, because one of the Europeans on this particular boat in the documentary talks about how nobody really cares, but maybe in the future we're going to be the people that nobody cares about, so it's our duty as human beings to look after them. And which I think is very interesting, because again, it's like that famous poem, you know, first they came for the whatever, and then they came for me, but nobody was left to worry about me. And again, even going to the Russell Brand's podcast, they're talking about, like, you know, nation states are dead, we have to organize either on a collective local level or this kind of like international solidarity. I don't agree with that, of course, but I think what they're arguing for is like this kind of left movement that is proactive and passionate, and these people were definitely that in the documentary. So I think you'd really enjoy that as well. Okay. And also as well, the one about the guy, the black guy, was it was interesting. That's just very well filmed, very artistic. And he dresses like the white people eventually because he's getting beaten up and he wants to fit in, which is a very natural thing. And his story is like he basically becomes them. And then one day they come across other black people and the English guys like shout, the white guys shout the N-word at them. And then the guy turns to the guy, the feature of the documentary, well, we don't mean you. Hmm. These guys are, but you're not. Yeah. And that's also interesting in the Russell Brand podcast, because they talk about how political correctness updates our semantics, but not really our attitudes, you know, which is also interesting as well. But speaking of the N-word, Mary's going to say it now. No, Viggo Morrison got in trouble for saying it in an interview for the Green Book. So before we kind of address that and give our take on it, can you give us a little snapshot of what the Green Book movie is? Also up for Oscar, well, it was up for... Well, it won the Oscars, actually, yeah.
It won the Best Picture, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, it's about... Well, it's based on a true story, which is one of the things that has been controversial or whatever, but it's basically based on the story of a jazz pianist that toured the southern states at a time where obviously there was still segregation, and for that trip he hires like an Italian
driver.
Yeah, an Italian chauffeur, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, and well, it's just the story of like how during that trip, well, obviously the Italian chauffeur was originally quite racist or fair racist towards black people, and well, I don't know, it's like there's a lot of issues, not just like race, it's also to do with class, and because in this case, for example, the pianist who's the black character comes from like the upper class, or so, like a completely different world from the Italian, much more educated.
I heard as well that it's a movie that is good but not good enough to win the Oscar, which won't be the first time in Oscar.
You hear that from me?
Yes. Also,
you're quoting me to mommy.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I have a quotes wall full of your quotes on my wall. That's why it's a quotes wall.
Okay.
Also, in my student center as well, on Friday. But that was like when he was in the mood where he was talking, and whenever I wanted to give my opinion, he just like just did listen to this, continued saying whatever he said.
Oh,
but he did say that about Green Book.
That's 2 wins for you.
Yeah, certainly is. But yeah, also you mentioned like some scenes that were a bit kind of cloying or stereotypical. There's one with KFC, I believe.
Yeah, no, I didn't believe. I thought it was okay because like it just felt like a bit cringy, but then something happened that stopped it from being cringy. So that happened a couple of times. I mean, I think the main people that took issue with it were like the family of the pianist, because, or the sister of the pianist, because they weren't contacted before making the film, and somehow like she felt that it didn't portray her brother in the right light or whatever.
Well, I haven't seen the movie, but I did see an article where they talk about how that movie winning the Oscars shows how the Oscars doesn't understand black people. That was the title and obviously the subject of the article. But before we talk about, I guess, the movie we've been kind of getting to, which is kind of the main focus of part two, I guess, it is interesting. Like, I mean, all the movies and all the short documentaries are really dealing with interesting things. The period one is about how like distributing these sanitary projects has changed their lives, has even given control over like finances, not just their body. I haven't seen it yet, but it sounds like interesting. The one about race relations in England, and this is compelling, it's about race. One's about, of course, about refugees and humanity, which even going back to the documentary about about Madison Square Gardens, General Patton, even after the war, felt that refugees were not people, and the Jews were the lowest of them as well. So, like, just how, even, like, after all they went through as a nation fighting this ideology of anti-Semitism, you had those pockets as well on the winning side, you know. So, and in the movies, Green Book about race as well, Cold War, which you've mentioned last week in the last episode, about the Cold War, obviously, but also like relations between people and East and West, and this movie that we're going to talk about now, which we saw last Thursday, and again the name of this piece.
Capernaum.
Exactly. So, great movie, wonderful. Can you set the scene for us and tell us what is the premise of this particular movie?
It's it's set in Lebanon, and it follows the story of a kid. That what we see at the beginning of the film is that he decides to sue his parents. And, and then the whole story... I have to say the trailer gives very little information other than the fact that the main premise is that he's suing his parents for bringing him into the world.
Yeah.
Which, well, I don't know. It sort of like makes you interested into... what is the whole rationale behind it. And then it just tells the whole story and everything that happens to the kid to lead to that point that is shown at the beginning when he's suing his parents.
Yeah, and you're right, because when you hear stories of people suing their parents, it's always, I don't know, they're spoiled or something. And that's what I was kind of expecting. Not that he was particularly spoiled, but something kind of domestic. And it is domestic, but in a far grander scale. I have to say as well, how it develops across the story is very organic. It's introduced really, really well and seems so natural. Because again, a practical standpoint is like, how does this even happen? But then you kind of see it and go, well, of course, that makes sense.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, it does.
And what's also interesting as well, I mean, not to give anything away really, but which is isn't, but obviously, as you've already said, this is about suing his parents. And it's a kind of metaphorical act. It happens in the movie, but in a way, it's kind of like a statement thing. And his case, you know, to represent all bad parents and represent all children who've had the misfortune of being raised by them or abandoned by them. And that, in that context as well, it makes a lot more sense. And it's a really, really good movie as well. And circling back to the refugees, we do see Syrian refugees there as well. You had some thoughts about that as well, that maybe not all of them were coming to, and some African refugees.
Yeah,
Ethiopian, and she's that Ethiopian character is quite significant in the movie as well. You had some thoughts about Lebanon and as a destination for refugees as well. Do you remember that?
Well, I remember the thing that we talked about was that you commented on the fact that perhaps Lebanon was just a stop before coming into Europe.
Yeah,
and well, it could well be, but I was also saying that. Lebanon, you know, other than the wars that has been obviously between Lebanon and Syria, but like Lebanon and Syria until recently were like, you know, prosperous places and safe places in terms of like in the scale of like the Middle East.
Yeah.
So it doesn't like seem as such a bad place, for example, to go to. Obviously, with the shortcomings and everything that any country has when it comes to, like, you know, living the sort of life that that we're talking about without papers. I mean, I think that's a key thing, like living illegally.
Yeah. Well, even in the movie, obviously that's they're caught a lot of the time, but there's a guy in there who's exploiting these paperless immigrants and these refugees, and he gets his comeuppance as well. So this shows that the state.
Do what do we?
I didn't say who it was.
True.
But what's interesting as well, because I forgot to mention this when talking about the Oscar short documentary about the refugees, is that it's also like set in the context in the real world now, where the European Union are trying to get the African National Congress to kind of process these refugees in Africa, which, you know, to the credit of the ANC, they're dead against that, because it's just a way for Europe to kind of clean its hands of the problem, in inverted commas, and like just outside out of mind, and a lot of them are treated very badly. And as we've seen in the documentary, people who are like in Libya, for example, were in prison, and terrible things happened to them. And we know in the Salvados documentary as well that terrible things happened to these people before they can even get to Europe. So Lebanon, I don't know what the story is. To be honest, I don't know what happens to immigrants or refugees in Lebanon. Based on the movie, it doesn't seem particularly extreme. But as you mentioned, yeah, the situation, if you're paperless, well, like in most countries, they're going to try and stamp down on that. But I'd be interested to find out what it's like, if it's a welcoming country compared to maybe some of the other ones in the region.
Well, I think my understanding is that it's a welcoming country for other surrounding Muslim countries. I mean, for example, like, basically they're almost like doubling their population now with like Syrian migrants that have been escaping the war. And well, Islam as a religion, everybody has a duty to
help
people from, like, fellow Muslims from other countries. So I know whenever there's been anything, whenever has happened, anything has happened, people from all the countries, you know, go to, like, give blood and this sort of thing. So there's a lot of, like, collective, like, solidarity within the Muslim world.
Yeah.
And that's already quite a few countries that that are in need, you know?
Yeah.
In this case, we were talking about Africans, and then I don't think, like, or at least in the movie, they weren't portrayed as being treated any worse than anybody else that was illegal. Just kind of like more in an alien way, because obviously they don't share so many things culturally. But even she was praised for how well she spoke Arabic, and
yeah.
You know, so yeah, I don't know. At least in the movie, yes, it would be interesting to know. But well, from the bits and pieces I know, plus the movie, it seemed more focused on the idea of not having papers, and obviously the state of like the prisons that we saw also in the movie. But well, this is an issue for many countries.
Well, definitely in Ireland, yeah, everywhere basically, in terms of the prisons being terrible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if like that style of prison, as is shown, like where it has, you know, literally like hundreds of people in the same room. I don't know if that exists in Europe.
No, I wouldn't say it. No, that wouldn't exist in Europe, though. No. Okay. But you would have overcrowding, not in that scale.
Yeah.
But they'd be overcrowding, of course. Mm. It's also interesting in the idea, like the parents, obviously, you know, they are very poor. But it just shows two things. One, how, like, when it, well, I won't say too much, but you know, they have a certain amount of children at the start of the movie, and at the end of the movie, there might be a different number. But,
fair enough.
Could be less, could be more. He kind of talks about how like the neighbors kind of rebuke him for not having some of his children, and it kind of shows attitudes to where, like, if you're poor, perhaps like white children is like their investments and like, yeah, they're important for society. But also as well, there's a great contrast, because the boy, who's an amazing actor, and even the baby's incredible.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Like there are like funny moments in it as well, but like, yeah, just wonderful acting. He is so compassionate and so big-hearted, and it's just a great contrast, because like the parents talk about being poor and what choice they had, but I guess the idea is, like, no matter how bleak the situation is, you never really have a right to, well, to stab someone in the back, but especially if they're your own flesh and blood, if they're your own kin. Mm. And I think it's a kind of personal testimony as well. So technically as well, because we spoke technically what we liked about Cold War, but how the film was shot, the atmosphere, all those kind of things. Was there anything that you really liked about that particular movie? In terms of cinematography, music, or whatever, montages?
Well, Kafanaumi, it was funny because I was noticing that, because somehow, like, the first third or so of the movie is actually quite slow. So if it almost feels more like a documentary, that there's very little dialogue and it takes a long time to set the scene with a lot of things that are relevant.
Yeah.
But at the beginning, in reality, the first third of the movie, not much happens that adds to the story itself, but rather to the setting and understanding, yeah, you know, the dimensions of the whole thing. But now that you mention about the music, which is something that we always notice, both of us, it came to a point where the scene was being set where I actually thought, this is very strange because, you know, there's been, the movie has been on for like half an hour and there hasn't been a single note.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, and it was funny because just as I thought that, some, yeah, music started. But it was very minimalistic, you, yeah, know, it wasn't like, I don't know, it was just like sounds, but music definitely didn't play a big part in it. So I think in a way that was, like done on purpose and probably added to the atmosphere, you know, because it was, everything was so like desolate that there wasn't even like,
yeah,
a space to something that makes you feel emotions that are not the ones that are being portrayed by the situation itself.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's very well photographed. There's great lighting in the movie, great colors. No, but these are very important because a lot of movies like mightn't do that well, and if they do it well, it really, you can tell subconsciously it's a movie, you know, if you're looking at it. There's very few flourishes in it, but it is well acted. The camera always faces the right way as well. So technically, there's not much to really say about it. It's the main focus is on the social aspects of it, but there are some nice montages, kind of like sequences that really kind of drive the story forward and kind of pack a punch. But yeah, in terms of music and kind of, I don't know, like Cold War had more to it, I think, in terms of the artistry of the movie, but lacking in the story.
Yeah,
but this had more fantastic story, fantastically acted as well. Yeah. Looks great. But a few flourishes. But that's not a criticism. Yeah. That's just.
Well, it's what the movie asks for. I mean, yeah, isn't really.
It's a very naturalistic movie. But there are some nice things as well in it. So I think overall, the best movie we've seen in our sequence. No.
Yes, I would say so. Probably one is not even worth mentioning. And
The Old Man and the Gun.
Yeah, and Cold War, as we said before, was visually very satisfying, but we were a little bit disappointed on the story. And this one, I don't know, I think you can measure how much you've liked a movie or what an impact has had on you from like how much you think about or how much you find yourself thinking about it in the years no. Well, in the years I suppose as well, but in the days after. And I've definitely found myself thinking about it a lot, you know.
Yeah, well, it is ultimately a story of hope and redemption. Yeah, you do, but it does make you think, and it's very thought provoking. So,
yeah,
4 thumbs up there from the both of us. No, okay. So, I think, do we have time for anything extra, or we go to part 3?
I think we'll go to part 3.
Okay, so Italian philosophy has to wait until next week.
Yes,
okay. Well, thank you for listening to that, and well, yeah, we'll see you momentarily. The plugging you have to do for Radio Public. Now's your moment.
Yes, Radio Public. I was going to say it again. Yes, listen to us on Radio Public. Please.
Some damn fine plugging.
You help us do what we do best.
You can find us on any platform, of course. And we do appreciate you listening to us regardless of, you know, whatever platform you choose. But if you do listen to us on Radio Public, you will be able to financially support this endeavor. You can also find us on elarpamedia.com and irishslicemadrid.com, where we have our blog. What are some of the articles we have done recently, which I think people could find interesting?
Well, we did one about some links between India and Ireland.
That is very true.
And we did one about some links between Ireland and the Basque Country.
That is true.
And we've done one about some links between... No, I don't think any more countries.
Well, also we've done one about Santa Muerte.
Yes, that's true.
So we translated a book. It was already in print in Spanish, but we translated it into English. And it's hitting the bookshelves very soon.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it was a very interesting experience translating an entire piece of work. We've mentioned this in previous podcasts as well, the prayers that stood out for us, and that's also represented in the blog articles. That's the most recent one, so I would highly recommend checking that out. In terms of the Basque Country one, I think we've mentioned that as well, just the musical links between the two countries. People, when I mention this to people, they always say, well, of course, naturally there's links between them, but actually not as much as you would think. But then the ones that exist are kind of interesting because of that as well. And then the links between Ireland and India, some very interesting stuff there. Because M. De Valera was a big part of the... Well, not a big part, but he was invited to celebrate Indian independence because of the example and the solidarity between the two different independence movements. And he also helped India construct its first constitution after it left the British Empire. And even in a kind of literary and cultural sense, W.B. Yeats was enamored by Eastern mysticism and this idea that outside the self, nothing really exists. It's all a dreamlike state, and the truth and life exists within you. And he found very interesting parallels between Indian stories and Celtic myths in terms of reincarnation, but also in terms of nature having this kind of vibrancy in life as well. So I didn't know about this Indian dimension to W.B. Yeats, so that was kind of interesting to learn as well. And the video of your Bollywood performance from 2 weeks ago is in double figures. It is lighting up YouTube, so you can find it on our YouTube channel as well. So where else can you find us? What are our other social media platforms?
Well, on Twitter at @larpa1.
Yep. And what else?
And I think we said everything else.
Instagram.
Well, Instagram is @larpa as well.
@larpa. Patreon as well, if you want to financially help us. And what else are we on? Oh, LinkedIn.
Yes, we have a company page on LinkedIn.
And it's doing quite
LARPA
well.
LARPA Media.
LARPA Media as well. Yeah. So yeah, LARPA Media is the handle.
Yeah.
You'll find us in one shape, way or form on across, I don't know, lots of different things. Anyway, so thank you for tuning into this episode. I know there's a bit of a break between this one and the one before it, but we'll be more regular in our episodes from now on. We double pinky promise swear. So you can join us then. Thank you very much for listening. This is me saying good luck.
And we say, we're gonna say good night now. That's because it's long.
Say ciao, bye, I don't know.
Bye.
The LARPA Podcast, the home for cultural chit chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.